Ulakoot, my name is Morris Prokop. I'm the Executive Director of the Ohala Hadigut Society, or OK Society, located in Nain, Nunatsiavut, Newfoundland and Labrador. Ohala Hadigut means people who talk or communicate with each other. I was with the OK Society as Program Director from 2009 to 2010, and returned to the Society as Executive Director in September 2012. I must say I feel very humbled to be here today. I'm here today to tell you about the OK Society, but I'm also here to discuss the challenges and potential solutions to preservation and revitalization of Indigenous languages. The Ohala Hadigut Society is the only organization that provides programming in Labrador Inuktitut, including news coverage of current events and PSAs, to the entire Nunatsiavut region in Labrador. Some of the major news stories we cover on an ongoing basis include the Muskrat Falls Project in protest, the Labrador Residential School Settlement, the decline of the George River caribou herd, and the mental health, housing, and language crisis in Nunatsiavut. Ohala Hadigut produces 20 hours of radio per week and 13 22-minute episodes per season of our TV program, Tamanavahut, or We Are Here, which airs nationally on APTN. We also record the Nunatsiavut or regional government's assembly meetings on video and work on various radio and TV projects that come to us. We have partnered with the National Film Board, the Cultural Division of the Nunatsiavut government, and with Torngat Secretariat Fish and Wildlife Division on just a few of these projects. Most importantly, we currently employ 10 full-time and one part-time Inuit staff members, not including two student staffers, who we employ in our radio and TV departments on an annual basis. The Ohala Hadigut Society has received funding from Canadian Heritage since 1982 and from the Tisiuk Trust, which is under the Nunatsiavut government, for the past several years. Let me tell you a little bit about the history of the OK Society. The OK Society was founded on the principle that Inuit and Labrador should have their own communication system in their own language. In fact, according to former Executive Director Fran Williams, the Labrador Inuit Association, or LIA, passed a resolution at their AGM in Mokovic, Nunatsiavut, circa 1978, pledging to accomplish exactly that. As mentioned in the OK Society's 1984 proposal for Labrador Inuit broadcast training, in 1978, the Labrador Institute of Northern Studies organized a conference in Mokovic that brought together native broadcasters from across Canada. According to what was written in the proposal, the Northern Communications Conference served as a catalyst for events leading to the creation of the OK Society in April 1982. Its mandate at that time was to aid and coordinate projects to increase the ability of North Coast communities to communicate. Ohala Hadigut's mandate is somewhat similar today, with more emphasis placed on the preservation and revitalization of Inuit language and culture, as well as communication. Along the way, there have been many challenges, from funding cuts in 1990 to a fire in 2005, which destroyed all the archived media materials the Society had at the time. But there have also been many triumphs. The OK Society funded a newspaper, Kenena Tunamut Ile Yuduk, the translation of which is To Whom It May Concern, or the KI Magazine, as it's more commonly known, from approximately 1976 to 1994. Unfortunately, it was a victim of funding cuts in the 1990s. The Society also helped establish community radio stations in each of the communities on the north coast of Labrador in the 1980s. In 1984, a training center was established in Nain with the assistance of the Inuit Broadcasting Corporation, or IBC. During its long history, the OK Society has partnered with the National Film Board on films such as Anne Budgell and Nigel Markham's memorable Last Days of Okok in 1985. In addition, Markham and the Society partnered on two other film projects on the Hebron and Nutok relocations, Forever in Our Hearts, Memories of the Hebron Relocation, and Without Consent, The Resettlement of Inuit of Northern Labrador. The OK Society started producing TV in 1985 with 10-minute productions that aired on the Inuit Broadcasting Corporation. The title, Labradoriamute, or People of Labrador, was taken from Labrador music legend Sid Dicker's song of the same name. The Society's 22-minute version of Labradoriamute first aired on TV Northern Canada, or TVNC, and eventually on APTN. Altogether, Labradoriamute ran for an impressive 25 seasons. Labradoriamute was replaced by Tamanavut, or We Are Here, in 2010, and it is currently in its seventh and final season of production. In December 2008, the Ohalahadigut Society opened a brand new building in which to produce audio and video. Visitors to Nain are quite impressed to find such an impressive facility way up on Labrador's north coast. The first time I walked into the building, I remember being quite surprised and impressed to see digital audio equipment in the radio department downstairs and HD equipment in the TV department upstairs. OK Radio made the switch from AM to FM in the Upper Lake Melville area in July 2016. That's what I was referring to before. Our old AM transmitter was turned off in September 2016. Now that the new FM transmitter in the Upper Lake Melville area is operational, we have the potential to reach another estimated 2,000 listeners at the Muskrat Falls hydroelectric site. And to that, I just want to add, because of stringent regulations from NAV Canada and also issues with the CRTC, that ended up turning into a four-year process just to get FM in Happy Valley Goose Bay when we had AM there for many years previously. And actually, an addition to your comments was we were actually operating under a native Type B radio station because the CRTC said we could, but they weren't aware at the time for some reason that we actually had a transmitter in Goose Bay as well. So it was kind of a mess, which unfortunately we ended up paying for literally and figuratively. The OK Society has looked to the future by recognizing the importance of social media to the broadcasting industry. We created a Twitter account and linked it to our Facebook page back in May 2013. The Twitter account and Facebook page have proven to be quite popular. Two of our most highly read and shared stories ever on Facebook were posted recently, both dealing with the controversial Muskrat Falls project in Labrador. For those of you who aren't familiar with it, the Muskrat Falls project has been under fire for many reasons. It's billions of dollars over budget, but more importantly, there are huge concerns about it contaminating the environment with methylmercury. There are also concerns that the North Spur area of the project will crumble, resulting in large portions of the Upper Lake Melville area ending up underwater, including the community of Mud Lake, which you may have seen in the news recently. Its residents had to be evacuated by chopper the other day due to the worst flooding ever in the area. In December 2014, we recreated our website with the capability of web streaming OK Radio to the public on a worldwide basis. Our radio programming is now accessible to mainstream media and to the general public everywhere through social media. Now let me tell you a little bit about our radio programming. The OK Society broadcasts 20 hours a week to over 12,000 people on the North Coast and the Upper Lake Melville region of Labrador, and of course globally on the World Wide Web. Approximately 60% of our radio programming is in Inuktitut. When our radio producers aren't on the air, the Society broadcasts the CBC North wraparound feed from Iqaluit. This provides additional Inuktitut content for our listeners. OK Radio programming includes Adjihanutit, or Nothing Like It, every Wednesday or weekday afternoon, except Wednesdays. It features music, news, weather, and a daily interview or recording of various events. Labrador Memories also airs on Monday afternoons and features interviews focusing on the stories of Labrador. One of the many people we featured on the program is Innu elder Elizabeth Panashaway, the mother of former Labrador MP Peter Panashaway. Our flagship Inuktitut radio program, Alinea Hanaginik, or Learning Together, airs on Tuesday afternoons. Alenia Haneginik features interviews, stories, music, recipes, contests, a children's segment, and of course, Inuttitut language lessons. Wednesday afternoons are reserved for Piusutihavut, or Our Way of Life. It is an all-Inuttitut show featuring an interview or recording in Inuttitut, and of course, some wonderful Inuit music. Our other program on Wednesdays is Sigusavut, or Our Children, which features children's songs and occasionally an interview or recording with children. Teen Rockers takes over Thursday afternoons. It also features interviews or recordings with teens, naturally, and occasionally the latest top 10 songs on the teen music charts. OK Radio ends the work week on Friday afternoons with the Country Music Hour. We are off the air Saturdays, but back on the air with the Inuttitut service from the Moravian Church in Nain on Sunday mornings. That's followed by worship music and a sermon from a pastor in Happy Valley Goose Bay, Carl Sonicson, who has been contributing to the OK Society for several years now. Sunday afternoons, it's back to music, requests, weather, and an interview or recording. Along the way, we've aired special call-in shows dealing with important Labrador issues, and even some memorial services on request of the families. People from Labrador, as far away as St. John's, and even right here in Halifax, have commented on how good it was to be able to hear memorial services for their loved ones all the way from Nain. I can certainly identify with what Elder Jack Anuak was saying at the conference in Iqaluit regarding the importance of community radio to the community and the 20 positive roles, he says, local radio plays in the community. At the OK Society, we realize the importance of these roles and do our best to fulfill them. In fact, I remember commenting earlier that with all the conversation we've had today, we can certainly, you know, it's really been emphasized the important role that community radio plays. All of the TV programs that the Society produces for APTN have Inuttitut voiceovers and English subtitles. As mentioned above, the OK Society started TV production in 1985 with Labradorimut, or People of Labrador. It was replaced by Tamanavut, or We Are Here, in 2010. Labradorimut and Tamanavut are similar magazine-style productions that document Labradorians on the North Coast and Upper Lake Melville area at work and at play in the Big Land. They have featured events like the Labrador Winter Games and the riveting Kane's Quest snowmobile races, as well as countless other events near and dear to the people of Labrador. Labradorimut was aimed at a more general audience, whereas Tamanavut is more youth-oriented, with a focus aimed at an audience of the young and the young at heart. The OK Society is currently in the process of pitching a new show to APTN, Ilania, or All of Us. And I will attempt to play a video presentation now. So this presentation consists of two elements, a segment from one of the original programs Ohala Hadaget produced, which was Nunak Siomut, or To the Beautiful Land. This was from circa 1985. And then another segment is coming up from a recent Tamanavut episode called Snowmobiles in Labrador. Hope you enjoy this. So, I hope you enjoyed that video. I wanted to mention that, I don't know if you noticed that little girl waving in the video, but that little girl is now a TV producer with the OK Society, our very own Christine Lamp. That's her Anatsiak, or grandmother, carrying her there. Pretty cute. In conclusion, during my time at OKS, I've learned that language and culture are directly linked to self-esteem. Lack of self-esteem is linked to many social issues currently facing Indigenous people, and all people, really, for that matter. That's why the preservation and promotion of Indigenous language and culture is vitally important to Inuit and Nunatsiavut, as well as Aboriginal people around the world. As Gretchen King pointed out to me, at the conference in Iqaluit, Charlotte DeWolf of TV Nunavut mentioned a study conducted by Dr. A.G. Ahmed of the Royal Ottawa Healthcare Group that found that in Aboriginal communities where at least half the population had conversation knowledge of their native language, the suicide rate dropped to 0.0 out of 100,000 people. So the importance of preserving Indigenous language cannot be stressed enough. That importance is echoed by Les Carpenter of the Native Communications Society of the Northwest Territories during an impressive speech at the Edmonton Conference as well. As stated by Mr. Carpenter, radio is a powerful tool in preserving Aboriginal language and culture. And here are some language stats from the Inuit fact sheet for Nunatsiavut, which is, of course, the Inuit region in Labrador in which Nain is located. The fact sheet was published on March 29, 2016, and is found on the Statistics Canada website. In Nunatsiavut, 25% of Inuit reported the ability to conduct a conversation in an Aboriginal language, while 25% of Inuit also reported an Aboriginal language as their mother tongue. So 25% is not a very high figure, obviously. Based on results of the Aboriginal People's Survey, 92% of Inuit aged 6 and older reported that speaking and understanding an Aboriginal language was important to them. So that's kind of a sign of hope, because these people want to learn, so it's probably just a matter of figuring out how to teach them. The 2016 Census Canada figures aren't available yet, but due to an aging Inuttitut-speaking population, I would say that 25% figure is definitely even lower now. There is no doubt that recent historical events, including the forced relocation from Hebron in the late 1950s, have had a severely adverse impact on the retention of Inuttitut and Nunatsiavut. In fact, an entire generation has seemingly lost its language. Not surprisingly, OKS is facing its own challenges with language today. Our senior radio producer is on long-term medical leave. She is one of only two fluent Inuttitut speakers on our radio staff. To date, we've been very fortunate to have at least one of our Inuttitut-speaking radio producers available on a daily basis. But now, inevitably, the winds of change are blowing. We have hired another Inuttitut-speaking radio producer, but at this point in time, we don't have any long-term solutions for the language challenges we're now facing. However, one of the potential solutions is that one of our community leaders, Silpa Sorek, who works with the cultural division of the Nunatsiavut government as language program coordinator, is planning on teaching basic Inuttitut courses in the near future. Several of our young radio and TV producers have expressed a keen interest in participating in this course, so there is hope on the horizon. One of the primary goals of the Ohala Hadigut Society is to play a major role in the revitalization of Inuit language and culture. That brings me to one of the main reasons I'm here today, which is hopefully to have a discussion on preserving and promoting Indigenous languages. I'm hoping to hear how other Aboriginal broadcasters are dealing with the challenges of losing language and cultural identity. So please feel free to speak up and contribute your thoughts to a discussion on this vitally important topic. Nakamik, thank you for listening.
I like your little movies there. Prior to starting a radio station and working in communications in Chapel, and I worked in education for 13 years, specifically in the language department. I was their IT resource development guy, go-to guy. We developed a lot of resource material, but we were always asking ourselves, what can we do that's going to get children interested in learning the language? We recognize that we're up against cable television, internet, music videos, you know, pop culture, and that's who we were competing against for the minds of our students. We tried everything. Short movies like this in Mi'kmaq language, I produced them 10 minutes long because class time is only 25 minutes, and so I produced a whole bunch of these, all in our language, all in traditional fishing and hunting. We developed interactive CD-ROMs, we did e-books, we did prayers on the interactive CD level, we did an online language archive, we used animations, 3D animation, cartoons and stuff on our website, stuff like this. And the name of our department ironically, is Itali Moata Zingmigmoe, and that's where we store native data. And so we again recognize that really what we're doing now is we're just archiving the language. The language is in decline, and we, the number of speakers is growing, and that we're at this point we're now just archiving the language. So we can start producing content as much as we can now. The least we can do at this point, I think, is to archive it. Nakumi.
It's a fair comment. One of the things I didn't mention in my presentation is that we're currently about to start a project where we're digitizing all of our media, and that's including the KI magazines from the old days, and that's what we're actually going to start with. And then we have a whole bunch of cassettes. I was talking to Brian about this earlier. We have a whole bunch of cassettes there when God only knows if they're going to work play or not, but hopefully they will. And if they do, then we're going to be recording those, of course, digitally. And we have a whole bunch of mini DV tapes for video, and as well as Sony XD cam discs. And so we're going to be archiving as much of that stuff as we can. And like, as I mentioned here, we had a fire back in 2005, which wiped out everything. So we don't want that happening again. So hopefully that'll, you know, certainly go a long ways towards what George is speaking of, preserving the culture, if nothing else.
I guess for all of us that have been in that line of work for the last 20 years, I think we're in that similar scenario. That's where we are too. And that's one of the things I pointed out to the chiefs or to our language department recently. Everybody had this fear that it was all lost because there's not too many people now. But like you said, we've captured the language and recordings. For me, in a way, there's, we can work with that storage or that vault. There is still an opportunity out there for young people that use this technology. I don't know. Our languages are still vibrant up there, still strong, but also on a decline. So, trying to answer your question, I think our identity was, wiped out, or there was a lot of confusion ever since residential school, ever since Christianity was forced onto the communities. Northwest of Ontario, it's fully, it's all Christianized. A lot of Bible societies, I don't know what to call them. I don't have a better word or title. And for us, Coast, it's more of the Roman Catholic or the Anglican. For the coastal communities, I think we were, the language and the, or the identity was pretty much wiped out back in the early 1900s. In terms of like having an identity, and the example I lived through is I went to high school in Peterborough back in 1977, and I was the only First Nation student in the entire school. And I guess it was a good thing for me. I didn't know it, but the kids, they were asking me questions about what my culture should be about. But I didn't know. I didn't realize, because I grew up on a Catholic community. So I didn't know anything about the culture, traditions, or practices, or everything like that. I was, it struck me. So I spent a whole year in the library. I had to reintegrate myself. And then that's how I kind of, got back on track. And I guess maybe it's the same for a lot of us. I remember too when television was introduced to our community. We were home from high school, and it was 1977. And prior to television, every evening, night, whatever, you would catch us all down by the hill, riverbank, or like a whole group, cousins, friends, whatever, the entire kids. We'd either be sliding, swimming, running around in the bush, getting into trouble, breaking windows, whatever. Just everything that a kid does. But on that fateful day, television was introduced. It was the summer of 1977. And that first day when it was introduced, and like I said, every evening everybody used to run to the baseball field because everybody lined up to get onto a baseball team. And we tried to sneak in about three games before the sun set down. So if you didn't make it there, you didn't get on a team, so you weren't playing. So anyway, that first evening when television was turned on, there was only five of us going down to the baseball field. We waited and waited and waited. Nobody else showed up. And that was it. I think that's what you hear today from young people. It's boring. There's nothing to do. For us, it was television. And we thought about going out, climbing up the tower and knocking out the signal. But we would have been in trouble, I guess. Yeah.
I really loved your comment about, and I loved the video. There is hope, just to let you know, in the Penobscot Nation in Old Town, Maine. There's one woman. She has the language, and she's the only speaker of the Penobscot Nation. And when you mentioned about the language putting put in a box, I myself would talk with other people. I was brought up in a school where I was the only native. And I would talk to others, and we find out who was residential schools. And that's when I found out when you spoke the language, they put the little box in your mouth, and they crammed it until it caused a great deal of pain. With me speaking the language, I was constantly hit. So it was beaten out of me, right, as a kid. So, but not very many people share stories like this because it's too painful, right? When you mentioned the box, it brought back, boom, memories, okay? She was the only survivor with the language. And she kept it up, and was adamant, like Nora was with the Truth and Reconciliation, adamant about it. Today, she's the director of the language being taught in the schools from kindergarten up to sixth grade. And it is practice and practice and practice. With the younger generation now coming, regardless if it's pronounced correctly or not, they are doing it. So it can be done. One of the things they did was they focused on what the Penobscot Nation lived by. And that was all life was in the canoe, traveling from place to place, and that's how they started doing the work. So it is to be optimistic. If you need to archive it, fine. But I think it is possible as a language for all nations it to be saved. I love talking with other nations in the language. To me, I'm just happy, right? So, Lali.
Morris, do you have any final comments, or do we move to Brian?
I think that's about it. Other than, again, thank you very much. I feel very honored to be here today, and thank you for the opportunity.
Bonjour. Brian and Nishkas from Fredericton. I'm at the University of New Brunswick now, and what I wanted to do today is talk a little bit about the facilities in the communities where I work and the people I work for. I want to begin too by acknowledging the territories where I'm working with the unceded territories of the Wolastoq Nation in along the St. John River in New Brunswick, and where I'm doing my studies, and the Anishinaabe Nation, Mike's territory in Northern Ontario, and then the Mi'kmaq traditional territory where this gathering is taking place. The reason I'm involved with a lot of this work is all this work are my grandchildren that are here. I've been very privileged to be a part of and learn about Indigenous people, First Nations, and the challenges and work that that's involved in that everyone here has been discussing today over the years. And this is all about our future generation. I have 9 beautiful grandchildren. I've been blessed and privileged to be able to have be involved with the Indigenous people and taught by my late wife, who was in Northwestern Ontario and Lac Seul First Nation. I knew very little personally going into all of this. I was as a settler, as an ally. I'm learning about all of these things, and being here today, as Morris talked about, is a real privilege. And I thank everyone for all the sharing that everyone does. I'm involved with this project, research project. I've been involved with this for 10 years. It's called the First Nations Innovations Project out of New Brunswick. Dr. Susan O'Donnell, she's the lead in the project. She's now my partner, my life partner, and that was, it's a love story that brought me to Fredericton. And and so, like, you know, things happen for a reason. And as Annie talked about, I think as everyone has talked about, it's all about that journey that we're all taking and the work that needs to be done. Your comments just now is just perfect, like, you know, in terms of leading to where we are. The project, Susan mentioned as well, there's a partner now in Alberta that we're working with out of the University of Alberta. So it's, and what this project has been doing is looking at the use of digital technologies in the communities and how, and documenting that over the years, over the past 10 years. And some of the publications, some of the partners that we've been involved with as a result of that, in terms of being able, we've got about 80 or 90 publications over that period of time. One of the things is having Indigenous partners in all of that, in those publications, so that we make sure that the community voices, if it's about a community, somebody from the community needs to be partnered in that. And the website that we use is called the firstmile.ca website. And I was mentioning to George earlier, the whole challenge of transferring and some of the challenges that we're talking about in terms of language with the CRTC, instead of always being seen as the last mile, the communities are the first mile. Like, you know, and if things are done from the first mile, then the resources are going to be put into the first mile instead of being put into the corporations to take care of the last mile. Always being taken care of from the cities and from other places. So somehow being able to have that community control and that community infrastructure in place, the adequate infrastructure, as George is so hard working at today. Looking at it from a whole community. So often we're challenged to look at it from an individual household. And in the communities that we're working with, that we serve, they're small. And the indigenous perspective is very much a holistic perspective. And beginning with the lands, the territories where people are, the place where people are, and what that includes then is the infrastructure that supports that, and then the services and facilities that are involved, and then the individuals, right down to the families and the households that we're involved with. And being able to look at it in a holistic way, I think, is really critical as we document in a number of different things. A little bit of a history. Back in 2000, we put in a proposal to be... I was working with Kiewetinohk Okmulgeechik in northwestern Ontario, and we were involved for a number of years, about 8 years, in developing IT infrastructure in the communities and working with a number of communities in the region of northwestern Ontario that Mike has talked about, that John works with as well as part of Wawate. And Wawate has been one of the pioneer, well, is the pioneer in communication. And we got involved with the... in the schools with the communication technologies and the internet. Introducing the internet in the schools is where it began. And from that building of infrastructure, we started looking at facilities in the communities. And I think Mike can best attest, John, you've been in a lot of the communities. The facilities where the radio stations are located always tend to be, like, you know, they began always in somebody's old home, as we just heard. I'm sorry, not old home, but somebody's basement or in a bedroom, a spare bedroom. Somebody talked about being kicked out of their bedroom. Like, you know, we've got all those stories, but like, you know, I went to Webequay, and there's an old log building down the hill, down at the bottom of a hill, and it's almost sinking into the ground, eh? And you know, you've been there? Oh my gosh. And the tower, like, you know, is down below the hill. Like, we do, people put up with a lot of things. What Mike talked about in terms of my challenge to him, but then, like, you know, people have been the most patient and kindest, and I've learned so much in that process as we move through that. But we're dealing with a technology now that's changing all the time. New things are being introduced, new technologies are being introduced. And so how do we accommodate that? Do we isolate it as a radio station, or do we start to look at it as podcasting, as radio broadcasting, as Maureen, what you're talking about in terms of doing your programs and online, using the web, all of those kinds of environments, and creating those kinds of spaces that at the first mile level can facilitate what Annie's doing, where the positions are in such a, where people have that opportunity, young people have that opportunity to get good quality jobs. Wawate and the training programs that they used to do in television and in radio, all of those types of things need space. We need to have training facilities. We need the infrastructure. And the telecommunications has been a long, slow process where we are. It's still where Morris is talking about. It's still being challenged as well. And how we, what Mike, I think, brings in is they own their infrastructure. The chiefs form the board that governs that infrastructure, or they have a board. I don't know what it used to be, the chiefs. This is still Five Nation.
It used to be the chief, but now it's a board.
Now it's a board. So, like, you know, but it's First Nation owned, and I think that that's a critical component of how we're getting the services into the community, so that the community then can set their own priorities and their own determination of those facilities and those resources. In North in the Northwest, where I was, we ended up being forced by government and the funding to get the fiber that Mike talked about, but Bell owns it. Bell brings it to the community and then sells it to the community. And those high prices that are determined are really a factor of Bell. To this transport that they're charging for determines what happens in the community. So how does the community have to accommodate all of that? And that becomes a major challenge for each of the communities as they try to build their own network, as what George is talking about in terms of cable, in terms of television broadcasting, in terms of radio broadcasting, in terms of web-based production, things like podcasting, training centers, libraries. Like, you know, they're non-existent in the communities except in the schools, and that's all volunteer. So bringing these kinds of resources in a digital format, the archives that we're talking about, being able to access it, being able to do what John was talking about earlier in terms of being sharing programs, like, you know, online, requires this infrastructure. But, so what we started to talk about and what the KO communities are setting as a priority for themselves as an economic development initiative, and I was mentioning this to George, they're going after funding to set up e-centers, multi-purpose centers that can facilitate this kind of these kinds of opportunities in the communities for the young people for future. The reality of it is it's going to change tomorrow. But to take that opportunity today, I think, is something that the chiefs have decided that they have to do. They did that 20 years ago when they came up with this idea. They're still working on it. We did get facilities, but we only got enough money for a little bit. Like, you know, just like the radio station got a little bit to put in the transmitters in somebody else's, usually in the band office, like up north where I work out of Poplar Hill. So all of that to be said, like, you know, it's about listening to the communities and doing the consultation at the community level and that work at the community level to determine those priorities. Back in 2002, I was involved in setting up, looking at the combining the whole idea of a whole community approach to infrastructure development, and like looking at health and education and economic development. And the communities all participated in that I was working with. And we ended up coming up with an e-community strategy that we post online at this website here. And the e-community concept, we took to AFN in 2012 and displayed it at that national conference in terms of that work that's being done. This is Poplar Hill, where I do a lot of my work right now in terms of my academic, my doctoral research that I'm partnering with. They built an a business center, and in there they have the e-center. But now they want to go to the bigger center. They want to grow it. In the interim, they have a number of these units for their cable. That's for the cable infrastructure and the fiber network, and that they roll out into the community. They have the Bell Canada Tower, where they have the cellular service, so they own their own cellular service as well. And that this is the cable infrastructure right here that you were talking about, George, for the coax cable that now is being moved, after 15 years, is being converted to fiber on a stage-by-stage level. So this kind of work, you can see, you know, an old band office, an abandoned band office is used for their cable. This is the cable television in Kingfisher Lake. But the one thing I was going to mention is, in that funding that Bell Canada got, the multi-million dollar, they claimed it was an $80 million construction project. These are their facilities that they put in every community so that they could then sell their services to the community organizations at a lower rate than the community, but the community has to buy that connection from Bell. Look at the facilities, how organized, how nice lit it is. It's got a little office space, and it's all part of the construction project. So that with public monies, they get the facilities, then they sell the services, they have to pay for the transport, like, you know, locally to the organization. Maybe sometimes it's fiber, paying $20,000, then you pay every month after. If the community owns it, then, like as Mike talks about, then they're able to benefit. The money stays local. This is Hat Lake. This is Deer Lake. It's an old building that's ready to fall apart. People go through the floor to get in. But again, like I woke up this morning thinking about something that one of the elders that I've been working with asked me to bring to this conference, is about the language. And anyway, that's what we've been focusing on the whole day. It is about the language, folks. And it's all, like, you know, and if anything, in the terms of the policy and the CRTC, I think there's a real opportunity to draw on all the resources that we've been talking about today and others. Because across the country, what Susan and David Perley, who leads the Mi'kmaq Wolastoq Center at the University of New Brunswick, they did a knowledge synthesis grant, and they produced this report about some of the language activities that are taking place across the country, and there's hundreds of them. People are working hard. Like, we've seen it all today. And so David, he's very big on the, and his partner, Amalda, they are very much involved with the Maliseet Nation Radio, Inc. And they have lessons online. You can go to Amalda's sites, pick up the lessons, and these are all examples of what's going on in terms of the language. Amalda now, she just started tweeting a month ago. And the whole thing with the language, like, you know, she, every day, like, well, not every day, but May. So I just picked up these today off the web. And so, like, there's these elders that are doing this work, this really important work, and they're going to, like, we've just witnessed everyone doing it here, too. And that's so important. What we're doing, I've been working recently with Melda on a language app. And we're working with Derek Baxter out of, and he worked with the Mi'kmaq people with the MK in, out of Sydney. And Derek has over 120 apps, language apps across the country. And down in the States too. But anyway, like Amalda's putting her voice, and I don't know how many hundreds of words, I ended up having to do the audacity breakout of the phrases and the words. But that's what the archives are about. You can use the archives to do these kinds of things, to put the language into action as well. So the Derek here, Derek Baxter, I don't know, he claims he's out of Sandy Bay now, but I think he's Ogoki, Martin Falls. But anyway, that's where his family is originally. And there's lots of other examples online, on Twitter, the Gabriel Dumont Institute, the Alan Sillyboy. Boy, from and what they're doing with art and everything else. So there's all these formats to be working with. One of the things that we're dealing with as well with the CRTC is what we call, we set up an organization, a not-for-profit organization called the First Mile Connectivity Consortium. And so we participated in the hearings for the telecommunications hearings on the basic service objectives. And it was a year and a half process of hearings and interventions and things like that. And we have a group of people that we work with. Everyone's a volunteer. But like after the hearings are completed, what we're able to do is submit our expenses, like the hours worked, whether you're and everyone has a different category based on their experiences to be able to submit their expenses. And we've done that for a number of different hearings now. We only found out about it. We were invited by the CRTC to do this back in 2012. No, it was 2013. Eh? Yeah, 2013, we had a meeting with them to find out more about the basic service objectives. And they said, well, why don't you start to participate and contribute to this? And so we have academics, we have community organizations, intermediary organizations that we work with out of MK in Sydney, the First Nation Education Council in Quebec, KO in Ontario, and then there's Alberta, it's TSAG, and the University of Alberta, and Laval University in Quebec. And what we do is submit opinions on behalf of the organizations that we're working with, and they tell us what needs to be said and how it, and we contribute those here to the hearings. Then there's interventions, there's questions that the telcos always ask because they want to maintain control of it. And out of that VSO hearing, I think most people probably know about it, there was the $750 million fund. And the basic internet became a basic service, so digital services become an essential service, and it for every household in Canada. So that helps Maureen's work if every household's able to pick up your pod. And on top of it, they recommend or they've advised the government that it should be a 50 megabyte connection to every house in Canada. And that means whether it's in Iqaluit or elsewhere. So there's this $750 million fund that's available now for access. It has to be matched and everything else, but maybe it can be used for some of these facilities. Maybe it can, like, you know, if we frame the story properly, and that fund, now they're going to determine, they've just opened up the hearings to determine how that fund is going to be accessed. And you can bet your life the telcos are going to do everything they can to keep, it'll be their money. But it's not really their money. You pay, we all pay for these connections. And they just skim a part of it off and put it into this catchment fund. And so what we're saying is the community should be able to access this fund, this $750 million fund, for their purposes, for their applications. And so that's what we're going to be presenting over these next, we only have about a month, the deadline for submissions is the end of June for this particular hearing to break up, to determine how this fund is going to be applied. But they need to hear everyone's voices. And so even a letter or a submission and getting involved in that, that's what I was talking with John about a little bit, John and Mike, like it's another one of these opportunities to get some experience in working with the CRTC and participating in their games as well. Just as you're doing in the broadcast area, what Gretchen is working on right now with the broadcast area, this is around the telecommunication area, which, like, I think they're trying to bring together in a lot of different ways too in the digital environment that's ahead of us. So as the First Mile Connectivity Consortium, we're going to be participating with our partners, and I would encourage others too in telling that story. John,
is that fun? Okay, so another partner I know that Wauwatin partner in Ottawa. When they did the hearings in Ottawa, like the hearings were covered by the BPF, which is the Broadcasting Fund. Now, will the telecommunications hearings have that same fund? Like, it's a fund that pays our organizations to go to Ottawa and argue our point.
The telecommunication fund, I don't think there's an actual fund. Like, you know, what we did in the last, the hearings where we presented about Telesat with the satellite, we presented about that, and we submitted an expense claim for $30,000 or something because we had this lawyer, professor, and she charges lots. And anyway, but she knows, we don't pay her as an organization. She knows that she is only going to get paid if they determine that the value of her contribution or our contribution, because it's through us that it's going, is of value. Then they break it out and they charge Bell. They usually, Telesat paid 50% of it that time. Yeah, tell us that paid 50, so I get a check. As the treasurer of First Nations Connectivity Consortium, I got a check for 50% of that from Telesat and 25% from Bell, and then 25% from Explorer. They don't like us anymore.
No.
Like, you know, but like, when else do you get checks from these guys? Like, that's what I was trying to, that's what I was mentioning. So it's not a fund, it's the CRTC.
It's forcing those big companies to pay back.
For the hearings that they all of a sudden. And the other thing that's going to happen, they just put out the call for this one, is there was a telephone subsidy that they had, and they called it the deferral fund, where the telcos were able to move money for high-cost serving areas, which includes all of Nan, most of Nan. And they're abandoning the telephone subsidies, so service, in place of this $750 million. So they want reactions to this. So keeping track of all of this stuff becomes a darn nightmare, but it affects our communities, the communities that we serve, that we work with, and who have helped me so much in my life. So, like, I look at this. Gretchen says she has it as her homepage. I'm not quite that bad. But it's hard to keep up with all of this. But the telcos have an army of lawyers. Eh?
Yep. Liars, did you say?
Liars.
But, like, you know, I just put down some ideas that we need to, that I need to always be thinking about and working with. I invite any kinds of comments and thoughts about any of that. But, like, you know, the intermediary organizations, and like I would say, Waute is an intermediary for the community radios. You facilitate this kind of stuff. You make it happen. Like, you know, we have these organizations that are so powerful and so useful to work with. They are spokespeople. And, like, you know, and we have them across the regions, eh? And they become really good allies. And then there's academics, you know, people that have been there, done that. And we've been, and Susan, I got to give her a lot of credit for the people that she's surrounded herself with. I invite everyone to go and visit the First Mile website for resources that are available on there, and the people that we've been working with over the years that are good allies to the work that has to be done. Like there's no easy solution, as we just heard. Like everything Mike just said, in terms of what the policy needs to be, how do we incorporate the language so that everyone in the community is able to recognize it, but everyone across Canada, like as a settler. I had no idea. And like now I'm really excited about the opportunity, especially after sitting there for about 50 hours working with Imelda, you know, in the language, like, you know, breaking out each word, each phrase. But like, you know, what Derek has created here is a dynamite application to be able to put this language into an app that people can access. Like, you know, somebody mentioned about the app for the Mi'kmaq. Yeah. I think that was you, Iggy.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, that's where it was out of MK that we that David got involved with the Willowstock one.
They're building right over there.
I also want to just acknowledge some of my partners, my personal partners in all of this work. Shirk has been really good to work with as they supported this gathering as well, and the research partners that I've been working with as well. And then the references, and then some of the contacts. So, Waliwan, Migwech.
You did mention that the e-centers were set up originally, you know, 15 years ago. So could you just say about what happened to them and the transition? And so what is it, the same vision now or a different vision now? Or
it's evolved. It's evolved as the, as the technology has changed. I was mentioning to George, for example, the digital cable system now that you can put into place with fiber is totally different than the individual transmitters that they had to put into place for television stations before. So, like, you know, the facilities were on a, we didn't have, like, we didn't get the money that was necessary to buy, to build the kinds of facilities that we had. So the air conditioning for these transmitters, like, you know, whenever they had 20 or 30 transmitters, like, you know, it was cooking in the summertime. And we, like, so air conditioning, proper air conditioning, proper storage, fire prevention, you know, all of these situations that have to be considered, like, you know, as new technologies, as the technologies evolved, as the infrastructures evolved, and as the needs evolve, because kids are coming home with these skills. They, like, especially in the remote communities, they're coming home and needing jobs. And they, like, you know, and that's where I think the future is really, the opportunity is with the young people. You know, if we can just move them into the proper pay is a big, important challenge. Like what Morris, 10 people being able to payroll, that is big. And what you're doing in Six Nations or like in the Mohawk country is just amazing stuff. But, you know, it's a challenge to be able to meet payroll and pay the young people to do this kind of stuff. And Maureen, like, you know, you know what it takes. And so it's just a struggle. But, like, you know, and I think that that's what we need to, we were able to lobby for this infrastructure fund. What about lobbying at the broadcast level for an operational fund to support that? We were doing that too. And so I like, you know, and I don't know whether this new fund will be able to actually, the telcos won't want us to be able to operate these kinds of facilities, obviously. But we're going to lobby for that. But I'd say the same kind of thing needs to be done at the broadcast level, the funding for that ongoing operation to, like, you know, and CRTC wrote a heck of a letter to, what is it, the ICID now, the Connect to Innovate program, and that letter recommended that the language and recommended all these different programs need to be supported, and so maybe the opportunity is there. And like, and I would say that the e-centers are going to evolve into something much bigger, much better in the communities, but I'd say every community requires that.
We've been working on, well, the hack-ups. Our latest business plan, well, in 2015, was to create four main hack labs in the communities, and then team them up with like the Cromarty High School in Thunder Bay, Lac Seul, so that the middle aged school kids, 7 and 8s, are being introduced to this stuff. By the time they get to Cromarty and Lac Seul, then they're getting high school, then they're getting a little more in depth. What we want, we're dreaming was, is that by the time the youth get to university, they're 5 to 10 years in advance of their fellow students.
Right.
So that, because when I went to school, we had confidence issues, esteem issues, and then you had to actually sit in a classroom and see, like, you, and obviously when you go to school in this mindset of shame and esteem, every non-native person is already 1,000 times smarter than you just before you walk in the building, because that's what's been programmed in your head your whole life. So then that's why I started this idea with actually Montessori schools for the communities, so that they could be learning at a, you know, kids don't know the difference whether they're genius or normal. You know, they're going to adapt to education. So I think
we call it an e-center. Like, you know, it's
they've been here for 15 years in the Maritimes?
No. In Kiwetinohk Okmulgeechik, what we called them back in 2000.
Right.
Whenever we sent in that proposal.
Right, e-centers.
Well, we called them technology centers at the beginning, yep. And then we converted it to an e-center. We never got the adequate funding, so they became very smaller units, and then they became multi-purpose units, and then they got converted to Head Start programs. And
yeah. I just want to go to Carolyn. Going to be leading. I don't know if people have realized that we've lost some members from CKRZ, so thank you for coming and traveling to Ottawa, or sorry, Halifax to be with us, and we'll see you all in Ottawa. We'll
yes. We are going to Ottawa, so thank you, Brian. That's excellent. I've been watching you for a long time. And that I just want to say thank you for the opportunity to be part of this group, and that hopefully we can, you know, help keep things moving. So on behalf of my team, they're gone down with the cars there. We've got to catch a plane shortly. So just wanted to say Chimigwech and Nyawa for meeting you all and hearing your stories and listening to our story. So great stuff. Thank you.
Well,
Chimigwech.
We're
trying. We keep trying.
You're working hard, but yeah. I think what John was talking about too is the difference what the First Nations have, that cities and urban environments find difficult to be able to capture, is this whole community. Because in this, like, you know, so what they do, like what we do, they're able to do because of the population sizes, they're able to have a radio station, they're able to have a television station, they're able to have libraries, multiple libraries, and they're able to look at individual households because there's enough of them to pay for all of that infrastructure. But what's unique about First Nations and the e-centers and the idea is that if it's thought about as a whole community, as the leaders have always taught, that's what they've taught me over the years, especially this character, right? You know, is that it's about the community, silly. Like, you know, or stupid, they call me stupid. Like, I think it's a real opportunity for First Nations, for Indigenous communities to lead, and the young people, my grandchildren and my children, how they feel about they're all working in the communities, for the communities. And so I'm really proud of my kids and my grandkids, and I want to see that grow and prosper for all. And I think that is what we're... these small communities, these small Indigenous communities, have that advantage. Nowhere else do they have that kind of experience. The cities don't have it. They can't have it. They're busy being taken care of. And like, I live in Fredericton now. It's as big as it can get. I tried Toronto one time. I lasted 6 weeks. But, I love Sioux Lookout. And, I loved the communities I worked with. And so, you know, this is what they've given me. And this is what, and the people I work with, this is what they asked me to bring here. The elders that I work with and the communities that I work with. So I appreciate that very much. So thanks very much for this privilege of being here today. And
thank you so much, Roger.